Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us. Hawaii Talks on the Conversation. It's Thursday, February 19th. 50 years ago today, President Gerald Ford signed a proclamation repealing Executive Order 9066. That presidential order sent thousands of families of Japanese Americans to internment camps during World War II. We revisit our conversation with Bill Kaneko, former Japanese American Citizens League president, about that point in island history. We remember author and historian Tom Kaufman and hear a story about the community working from the ground up to protect neighbors targeted by the government. We also revisit our interview with an author who penned the first children's book to tackle Hawaii's incarceration camps. Plus, we remind you of the power of a traveling collection of yellow bulls. You're tuned to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. It's been more than 8 decades since 120,000 Japanese Americans were sent to incarceration camps following the attack on Pearl Harbor. Today, February 19th, marked the 84th anniversary of Executive Order 9066. It's a law that sent this country down a path from which we're still healing. Bill Kaneko is past president of the Japanese American Citizens League here in Hawaii. We talked to him about marking this point in time in our nation's history.
In Hawaii, there were about 2,000 Japanese Americans that were interned primarily at Sand Island and Honouliuli, as well as some 1,500 Japanese Americans who lived at or around very sensitive military sites like Pearl Harbor and Lualualei and other places, and they were displaced from their homes. So it had far-reaching impact, not only for Japanese Americans on the West Coast, but here in Hawaii as well.
So you often hear a lot about, you know, the internments, you know, they're in California, but not so much about Hawaii. I mean, what can you share about those stories?
Yeah, and Hawaii was a very unique situation. You know, at the time of the breakout of the war, about 37% of the state's population comprised of Japanese Americans. So it was not feasible economically and otherwise to displace, you know, over a third of your population. So as a result, the Japanese Americans who were interned had perceived, and I want to underscore the term perceived, ties with Japan, which included Buddhist ministers and Japanese language school teachers, editors of, you know, Japanese newspapers, and they were interned at Sand Island and Honouliuli. So I think for the practical effect was that, yeah, you could not displace a third of your population, so they targeted community leaders in the Japanese community.
Well, you know, I went and pulled up the order, and it really is chicken skin, you know, because it says, yeah, the evacuation of all persons deemed a threat to national security. Oh, gosh, just gives you the chills.
Yeah, and just think about wartime hysteria at that time, you know, when the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor and, you know, not only here in Hawaii, but, you know, for Japanese Americans, particularly living on the West Coast. And preceding that, all the kinds of racism and racial hysteria for, you know, Asian Americans, you know, as a whole. Prior to, you know, the bombing of Pearl Harbor, there were anti-Asian laws and alien land laws that prohibited Asians from owning land and becoming citizens and immigrating. And then that led up to, you know, the internment of Japanese Americans. So it was a very, very scary time for not only Japanese Americans, but for all Asian Americans living on the West Coast.
Through the decades, you know, there have been stories that have come out about that time in our history. There are those wonderful pictures, I think, that George O'Keefe took, you know, kind of just bearing the soul of the kinds of things that, you know, went on in those camps and, you know, how the guns were in the direction of the people inside the camps and not
right, pointing
outside.
Inward mm-hmm. as opposed to outward. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so those images yeah. mm-hmm. speak volumes.
We always have to remember what happened some 80 years ago so it does not happen again. But unfortunately, I think, you know, recently in particular, there has been a lot of incidents against Asian Americans. Asian hate crimes are in record numbers. And in addition to that, Black Lives Matter. And so, you know, the whole issue of race relations and the need to be able to have a more equitable and fair society can and should be on the top of our agenda. And that's why, you know, having events like EO 9066 is very, very important for us as a community.
And, you know, there are stories about those who really felt hurt that they had to defend their loyalty to this country, that was even questioned.
Yeah, and they were Americans and they ended up in barbed wire. And the irony of it all is that the most decorated army unit in our nation's history was the All Japanese American 442 Regimental Combat Team in the 100th Infantry Battalion. And, you know, our fathers and uncles and brothers fought in Europe as Americans while their, you know, relatives were behind barbed wire, particularly, you know, for the Nisei soldiers living on the mainland. You know, there is a lot of unfairness in all of that in terms of what the Japanese American community had to do to be able to prove their loyalty.
And we are losing a lot of those veterans, you know, from that greatest generation. We are seeing the numbers dwindle, folks that were in those camps. I guess it's important to really keep the stories alive.
Right, most definitely. So that's what the JACL is doing. And related to that, the veterans groups like the 442nd and the 100s and the MIS, there's a lot of sons and daughters groups that continue to keep the flame alive. Very important. And institutions like the Japanese American National Museum and here even locally at the Japanese Cultural Center of Hawaii, where there is a permanent exhibit of the wartime internment in Hawaii. I mean, having that continued remembrance is so important for our community. And even to be able to educate, you know, our younger ones, like my sons and his sons and daughters and generations to come, really to remember what happened so it doesn't happen again.
Well, you know, I came across part of that immigration history that involved someone here in Kaimuki. Kaimuki Dry Goods, and you know, there was a case that went all the way up to the Supreme Court, and he was wanting to be naturalized as a citizen, and the Supreme Court said no, so he came back home to Hawaii. I just remember talking to the family, and you know, one of the gals said, I didn't know this story, and she said, the first time I knew about this was I saw my grandfather's picture in a history book. Because the family didn't talk about it. And so she learned about, you know, his sense of pride and his fight. Yeah, I guess it's so important that the stories are told and that they live on.
Right, most definitely. And even for our family, like my father, for example, was in the Korean War. And he rarely spoke about his experiences, but also, too, you know, for many of the 442 and the 100th and the MIS veterans, they're very humble and sometimes don't like to speak about their experiences. But that's why, you know, having museums and institutions and stories and radio shows like yours really cause us to create a pause to reflect and to remember what went on is such an important aspect of our current society.
That was Bill Kaneko, Japanese American Citizens League past president, whom we spoke to in 2022 about the order that sent thousands of Japanese Americans to internment camps following the attack on Pearl Harbor.
Thank you.
You're tuned to The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. Today we mark 84 years since the signing of Executive Order 9066 and exactly 5 decades since it was repealed. We honohoe our interview with the late Tom Kaufman, the reporter turned author, published a history of internment. We reflect on his book titled Inclusion, How Hawaii Protected Japanese Americans from Mass Internment, Transformed Itself, and Changed America. We spoke with Kaufman and former journalist Barbara Tanabe in February 2022. Tanabe's family's internment experience in Seattle gives context to this time in our history. Kaufman starts us off.
Well, I had done a lot of work as a political reporter covering the state capital and the earlier years of statehood. And in the process, I became fascinated with, sort of obsessed with, what were the antecedents of statehood, and particularly how was it that Hawaii got through the tremendous strain of the war, Hawaii having been attacked by Japan and having what was then a 35% to 40% Japanese ancestry population. So slowly I began working on the question of why had Hawaii basically gotten through this crisis better than one would reasonably expect, and I would say very well, actually, because I think it did lay the basis for Hawaii statehood, in contrast to the tremendous tragedy and mass injustices that occurred in the West Coast states. So that was the question that drove me to begin to piece together the research base that went into this book.
And Barbara, why don't you jump in here? Because your family was in one of these internment camps.
Well, thank you, Catherine, and thank you, Tom, for doing all the research, because as children of Nisei parents, we never knew about the evacuation, the arrest, the detention, and having to live in camp all those years. I did not find out until I went to college, the University of Washington, and my grandfather told me about it. My father never mentioned it at all. So that's when, you know, Ji-chan is what we called our grandfather. Ji-chan told us, yeah, you know, it was kind of rough in camp. And then I said, what camp? And that's what started the whole thing. But not only did I find out about the fact that the entire Tanabe family, which included 3 children plus my dad and my grandmother, the entire family was evacuated first to the Puyallup stables where they kept the horses until Minidoka was ready to accept the Seattle area detainees, the Japanese Americans. There were about 10,000 of them in the area, and they were transported by train to an area near Twin Falls, Idaho. It was called Minidoka, and they had put together shacks, and that's where my grandparents stayed throughout the war. He worked as a cook there. But, you know, the reason that they ended up in Seattle was because originally my grandfather was running a cafe in Montana to feed the railroad gangs that were working on the railroads, and the cafe got torched. They had to move to Seattle, and that's when they got caught in all these mass arrests. It was a real eye-opening experience for me to find out about what had happened to the family. And, of course, no one discussed it. No one talked about it. They just made the best of it. They eventually resettled in the Seattle area. It took them a couple of years to finally get back and start all over again, but they never talked about it until I started to ask questions. This was in the 1970s. In 1971, I was a rookie reporter, and I decided to do a story on what happened to the Japanese Americans and the internment camp at Minidoka. And that was the first time a lot of these people had even talked about it. It's just really quite sad, but also inspiring to know that to this day, even though they went through this horrible, horrible experience, they consider themselves to be Americans, not just Japanese Americans.
And Tom, you know, in your research and this book, you highlight a couple of people who really had a hand in this decision to not open internment camps here or to send so many people away.
there was a circle of people who began working consciously and actively on the gathering threat of war and what kind of disastrous consequences it could have for the Japanese community. The characters that I focused on the most were, first of all, Charles Hemingway, who was practically the lifetime chairman of the Board of Regents and mentor to many, many young local students who went through the university. Two of them particularly had been sort of star students. One was Shigeo Yoshida, who was a star debater, an intellectual, a writer. And the second person was Hung Wai Ching, who was a star athlete and eventually a really well-known YMCA youth worker. These two young people were mentored by Hemingway, and as the war approached, he called on them to get involved. And then progressively, the key people who were involved were the FBI agent, Robert Shivers, who was assigned to Hawaii, and the person he tapped into to guide him because of his lack of knowledge about the Hawaii scene, a young police officer who was making a name for himself named Jack Burns.
Right. Only went on to become a governor here. You know, one thing that I was struck by was that these key folks were on this council, kind of an informal hui, you know, advisory group that really were kind of a think tank for the powers that be as they were making these decisions.
Well, they built a circle of discussion and knowledgeability and trust among themselves in this long lead up to the war, where they anticipated the war, and they then became, in essence, the advisors to the martial law government. And they played a strong role in guiding the martial law government away from the mentality of cracking down and instead involving the Japanese community in the war effort. Very quickly, that question of involvement became whether Japanese Americans would serve in the military, from which they had been completely banned at that point.
And Barbara, as you read this book, what were you struck by, given your family's experience?
Well, first of all, it was just so different from what my father and my grandfather explained to me happened on the mainland. There was no group. There were very, very few people that spoke out in defense of the Japanese. And it wasn't until much later that I learned that the University of Washington president and many faculty members tried to stop the evacuation. They met with the U.S. Army, but they were powerless because the politicians uniformly wanted all the Japanese arrested. And I remember one politician who did not. He was the mayor of Tacoma, Harry Kane. And I interviewed him back in 1971. And at that time, Harry said to me, the reason why the Japanese were all arrested is because of the competition by other farmers who wanted to take over the very successful truck farms run by the Japanese Americans. And these Japanese farmers were the ones that really got Pike Place Market started in Seattle, Washington. So, you know, there was this organized and very strong opposition on the mainland. But as I was reading Tom's book, I was so impressed with the vision of Mr. Yoshida and Hung Wai Ching and other young people. They were in their 30s, and they had this vision of a democratic Hawaii where all the races were able to participate in society. And I'm thinking, wow, they were brave. They were leaders, really inspiring leaders. And they had this tremendous vision. And because of their commitment, they were able to pull off what nobody would envision could happen on the mainland. So I was just really quite impressed with the generation of leaders, young leaders that Hawaii had and what was lacking on the mainland.
That was Barbara Tanabe talking about her family's perspective about the mass internment of citizens of Japanese-American descent on the mainland. We will continue our conversation with Tanabe and the late author Tom Kaufman after this short break.
Support for HPR comes from Hawaii State Federal Credit Union. Learn more about home loan options with an appointment at hawaiistatefcu.com. Federally insured by NCUA, Equal Housing Lender.
Saturday night on The Real Deal. We'll celebrate the birthday of the composer and pianist Tab Dameron, one of the most important figures in the early days of modern jazz. Join me, Seth Marco, Saturday night from 8 to 10 on HPR 1 as we celebrate Tab Dameron.
Support for HPR comes from the Olson Trust, with a mission to support growing sustainable agriculture, protecting natural resources, and investing in Hawaii's people. OlsonTrust.com.
Welcome back. If you're just joining the conversation, we're airing a special broadcast marking a half a century since the repeal of an executive order that triggered the internment of 120,000 citizens of Japanese descent during World War II. We've been highlighting a book called Inclusion, How Hawaii Protected Japanese Americans from Mass Internment, Transformed Itself, and Changed America. We continue with our 2022 interview with the late Tom Kaufman and Barbara Tanabe. Tom, this Council for Interracial Unity was so instrumental in setting Hawaii on this path, developing into where we are today.
Yes, it evolved into this advisory group, the morale section of the martial law government. And through that agency, the key people involved, basically, above all, Hung Wai Ching and Yoshida, and increasingly John Burns, set out to organize mobilization groups, mutual support groups in every ethnic group in every island. And to a great extent, they achieved this goal. And it was from that base that the 442nd, the 100th Battalion, and then the 442nd were organized. But it was through those networks that tens of thousands of people were involved in some way in the war effort by giving blood, buying bonds, getting out and working in what was called Kiavi Corps, which was basically do the brutal work of clearing out brush and Kiavi along the beaches so that the beaches would be more difficult for the Japanese to invade were they to try that. It was that kind of involvement that raised people's spirits, gave them a sense of purpose, and rescued people from, you know, what Ching and Yoshida feared would be a downward spiral of disillusionment, despair, and then disloyalty to the United States. So basically, they worked at and strategized and led a process of building loyalty and involvement And this, crucially, infected the United States Army, the FBI, eventually the War Department, and key people in the United States government. So it led to this turnaround.
Yeah, I mean, when you think of what it did, the trajectory that was set by these events, it is amazing, you know, because you've done so much research and you've documented it. I go back to the beginning of your book where you talk about, you credit folks over at the University of Hawaii. They were moving things around, renovating, and they came across a couple of shoeboxes with this priceless material that then you were able to delve into. I love that story.
I'd worked on documentary film projects, much more superficially dealing with the subject. And I was at the Archives and Manuscripts at Hamilton Library one day, and the archivist said, "We just completed a move from into our new wing, and as we're moving all this material, we saw these three boxes of archival material in, you know, great disrepair, but there they were." And I leafed through them, and so the archivist said, "Tom, they look sort of like the subject you're interested in. Would you like to look at them?" And as I devoured them, I realized they were the lost archive of the morale section. I'd actually spent a fair amount of time in Washington, D.C. in the National Archives looking for them, thinking they would have been archived through the military government. But they never were. These were like the personal archives that basically Shigeo Yoshida stowed away. And it was an enormous amount of new historical information in the process.
Well, Barbara, what did you think when you read that? Because I just immediately, you know, my heart just leapt. It was like, oh my gosh, I can just see.
I agree with you. I mean, as reporters, I mean, good heavens. First of all, I was just totally impressed with the depth of Tom's research, and it took him 10 years. But I also was so curious about the attribution that I read the footnotes as I'm reading along. And the footnotes to me were even more interesting because it shows how Tom had to go searching for things. And then some of it was just fell into his lap, like the University of Hawaii, the Yoshida papers that were tucked away in a little box. But, you know, the other thing is, those guys back in those days wrote things down and they kept it. And I remember my dad was the same way. He kept everything. I don't know if we do that today because everything is on digital form. And I'm just wondering, gosh, if this were to happen today, would we be able to recreate something 80 years hence to correct an injustice with materials that we have today? I don't know, because there's so much misinformation. I mean, there was misinformation back then too, but the misinformation today is digital. It's very hard to correct things today. So my hat's off to Tom for finding everything and pulling it all together and then sticking with it for 10 years.
Yes. What a priceless find, Tom. And it was, I felt your joy to know that you had discovered this to set you on this path.
It was just that moment. It was quite a buzz. And actually, I was always energized by going back to it. I should, while we're on the subject, credit my mentor, co-worker, guide in this in many ways, was the late Ted Tsukiyama. Ted went with me to the archives and would, in essence, interpret for me things that didn't quite make sense or names that I did not recognize. He recognized and he gave them meaning. And I'm forever indebted to Ted for that help.
That was author and filmmaker Tom Kaufman and Barbara Tanabe talking about Kaufman's book entitled Inclusion, How Hawaii Protected Japanese Americans from Mass Internment, Transformed Itself, and Changed America. Memorial services were held for Kaufman last month. He was remembered for his contributions and love for our community. It started with a shell collection. When she was a child, Sharon Fujimoto Johnson inherited a set of old matchboxes. Inside were dozens of shells that her grandfather collected during World War II. He'd been incarcerated at Sand Island and Honouliuli internment camps, and family members say he never fully recovered from the traumatic experience. Some 2,000 Japanese Americans were incarcerated in Hawaii during the war. Fujimoto Johnson is the author and illustrator of Shell Song, the first children's book about the incarceration camps in Hawaii. The Conversation's Maddie Bender spoke with Fujimoto Johnson back in September about how she told her family story in a children's book.
When I was about 10 or 11, we were actually living in Japan at the time, and my father gave me his father's shell collection and told me it was shells that my grandfather had collected in incarceration camps during World War II. So, you know, I was pretty young, but I understood that these shells were precious and that shell collection traveled with me through the years. You know, I always wanted to be a writer. And, you know, I had also grown up hearing stories from my grandmother who told us all the stories about the years, you know, during the war and after the war. And my grandmother actually wrote a handwritten autobiography in Japanese and also a collection of probably about 50 tanka poems, also in Japanese, that I ended up translating in college. She entrusted her work to me. But I always wanted to figure out a way to tell this story myself. And it took me, you know, many years to figure out how to do it. And at one point, I just realized that it was the shells. You know, the shells carried my grandfather's story through the years and across generations. You know, he had died very young at age 49. His health had never been good after the incarceration camps. And so I had never had the chance to meet him or hear his story, but I had the shells that he had actually collected with his own hands. And so that was really the inspiration for my children's book, Shell Song.
Briefly tell us what the plot and the arc of Shell Song is.
Yes. Many people are probably aware that on the West Coast of America, entire Japanese American communities were rounded up and sent to prison camps. Not as many people are aware that Hawaii had incarceration camps. On every island, there were places where Japanese Americans were held. So my grandfather was a U.S. citizen by birth, but because his father owned a trading company, Fujimoto Trading Company, in Hilo, that was the largest trading company at the time between Hawaii and Japan, my grandfather became a target of the FBI. So my great-grandfather, the owner of the company, was in Japan at the time that transportation was shut down after the attack on Pearl Harbor. So in his place, they decided to arrest my grandfather. So Shell Song is, in a sense, a very complex story. Like, it's a very large story of the incarceration camps here in Hawaii. It's actually the first children's book about the incarceration camps in Hawaii. It is, though, a children's book. So when I was making it, my thought was that it really needed to be centered on the shells. You know, shells are tangible objects that children understand and love. And also for me, that's where the story began, you know, when I was 10 years old, 10 or 11. I've described it this way, you know, the incarceration camp story is large and complex, but I didn't want to write a whole orchestra in this book. I wanted there to be a simple melody line, and that melody line is the shells. So in the book, my grandfather loves shells before the war. He collects more shells in the incarceration camps during those difficult years, and I imagine him thinking about his family that he left behind in Hilo and associating shells with, you know, his wife, his two children, and the baby that he had never met because the baby, my father, was born after he was taken away. And then I imagine him bringing those shells home and the shells being passed down through the generations. So that's kind of the story arc of Shell Song.
I think probably perspectives have changed, but I just think back to being a kid going to Hebrew school, and one of the field trips was to a Holocaust museum, and one of the students didn't go because her parents didn't approve her to go on that trip.
Oh.
What are your feelings on having difficult conversations about history with children, whether it's quote-unquote appropriate?
You know, interestingly enough, early on in the process, when I was just working on the manuscript, someone did ask me, why a World War II story for children? Like, isn't that a little bit heavy? And yes, it is a heavy topic, but I truly believe that children need to have access to stories that are outside of their own known experience. And in fact, right now in the world, for some children, war is their reality. And both for children who know these difficult things and children who don't, I feel like these books are so important. And ultimately, hopefully, having these windows into other worlds, you know, allows children to grow empathy for people who might be living life a different way or experiencing life differently from themselves.
I really want to talk about how you incorporated mixed media into your illustration, scans of the shell collection, and even, what would you even call this?
Like these are end papers.
End papers. Yes. Okay, describe what's going on in the end papers and a few of the other really delightful Easter eggs that have so much meaning to you and your family.
Yeah, so on the end papers, I have some sketches of shells, but behind that, this golden yellow patterned color, and it's from actually the texture and color from my grandmother's wedding kimono. And that actually gets repeated early on in the wallpaper in their home scenes. And for me, it kind of represented the warmth and safety of home for my grandparents, especially prior to the war. And also on that page, there's the logo of Fujimoto Trading Company, my great-grandfather's company. I found that little matchbox cover on eBay, and so I obviously snatched it up quickly. My grandmother's clothing is actually constructed from fabric from her wedding kimono. And also, let's see here. Obviously, the actual shells, my grandfather's shell collection is in the artwork. And on the pages in the incarceration camps, there's soil from Honouliuli and also Sand Island. Those were the two incarceration camps my grandfather was in. So thanks to the Japanese American National Museum, I had permission to have these soil samples photographed and was able to use them in my book. And it just added a layer of authenticity for me and meaning to have that soil in the artwork.
I like your point about how it lends authenticity when thinking about the soil. But you shared that the day after this book was published, you were invited.
Yes. So it was just a serendipitous series of events that I happened to be invited by Honouliuli National Historic Site. Christine Ogura is the director. And she was trying to invite a group of descendants to join the meetings in which they were talking about the direction that this national park would go. Shell Song came out in April, and the day after I went to Honouliuli. So I had made this whole book without ever being in the places that this book came from. And so it was incredibly moving to actually be at Honouliuli. So in my grandmother's autobiography, she talks about taking the three little kids to visit and how they traveled on a red dirt road. And in fact, it's the same red dirt road that we traveled on. I had my daughter, my 11-year-old, with me on that trip. And so we went down into Honouliuli, which is located in a very deep, isolated gulch between two mountains. And so when you go down into the gulch, you realize like how isolated it was. You can see a sliver of sky, but on either side, there are these mountainous walls. And so in fact, the Japanese-American civilians nicknamed this place Jikokudani, which means Hell's Valley, because it was so hot and isolated, and there was lice and mosquitoes, and they were out in the elements. My grandmother, you know, kind of wrote about all of this, but to be there myself, and it was very hot, but there are trees there now. The jungle has sort of taken back this land. And there was a breeze, and there were trees, there was shade, you know, I had a hat. But I imagined being there indefinitely, not knowing if or when you were ever going to get out, and having actually no shelter and no trees. And it was really a moment for me in which I really felt like I could feel what my grandfather, like the despair that he felt in those moments.
And to have your daughter there at the same age that you were first introduced to your grandfather's story. There's that moment of circularity.
Yes, very much a full circle moment and like a feeling of completion. And actually, currently, I have a museum exhibit at the Japanese American Museum of San Jose in California. And my grandfather's shell collection is there, along with a lot of family photographs and artifacts, my whole family story, and really, it's an exhibit that invites people to think about their own family heirloom stories and how to preserve and hopefully pass them on. Because I guess one of my personal missions now is making sure that not only do I share these stories, but that I make space for the next generation to also feel like they can own a part of it and retell it themselves. Because it really has to continue on beyond my generation.
That was author and illustrator Sharon Fujimoto Johnson and HPR's Maddie Bender. Fujimoto Johnson shares that a selection of her grandfather's shell collection will be on display through the end of November at the King Kamehameha V Judiciary History Center. Her daughter wrote several poems after visiting Honouliuli National Historic Site. Those can be viewed at Hawaii's Plantation Village in Waipahu until February 20th. Our final story today is about the art and politics of 120 Yellow Bulls. It's an artist's visual message to remind and to warn people about what may happen to freedom when fear rules the day. Setsuko Sato Winchester is a former National Public Radio journalist and a sculptor and photographer. She's the force behind the Yellow Bull Project. Winchester's handmade bulls have been set up at sites symbolic for immigrant justice. Her work and the photographs of them then bring attention to these issues. She's covered a lot of ground, creating installations at 10 major World War II internment camps on the continent. Today, we hanaho our conversation with Noe Tanigawa. She covered Winchester's 2019 visit to Honouliuli, Hawaii's largest and longest-running internment camp.
Well, here's how Setsuko Sato Winchester's Yellow Bull Project works, okay? She places her handmade yellow tea bowls at sites that are symbolic for immigrant justice. Her work and the photographs then bring attention to the issues of immigration and naturalization. And she visited Honouliuli. That's Hawaii's largest and longest-running camp. She was here last week for that. Now, you know, people know what happened there, right? People of Japanese ancestry were targeted and removed from society through a presidential executive order. That's really important to remember. The justification was national security. And at Honouliuli, by the numbers, 4,000 prisoners of war, and they were pretty much Japanese, Koreans, Okinawans, and a few Italians. There were 2,000 approximately number of Hawaii detainees there at Honouliuli, and about two-thirds of those were American citizens. There were 8 women there, and one thing they had in common was that they all studied the Shinto religion. And we get to 0, and that is the number of people who were ever tried or convicted of any charges there. But What's informative is that 343 people of Japanese ancestry were picked up within a couple of days of Pearl Harbor. And you just think, how are they so efficient about getting these people? A sample detention list had been prepared in 1937. Wow. Newspaper chains that were run by Randolph Hearst and others had been promoting a yellow peril kind of hysteria on the continent, and claims of national security took root in that kind of atmosphere.
So by 1941, there were over 800 pieces of legislation, federal, state, and local, written against Asian peoples. While other groups have slowly integrated and become American, you know, whether it's Italians, Germans were not considered American, you know, Italians weren't considered American, Irish were not. But there was never any law that excludes Irish. But there were laws against Black people. There are laws against Asian people. So when it is the law of the land, it's the government that has to go after you, right? The government can't protect you.
That's Setsuko Winchester. She's really interesting. She has a degree in journalism, used to work for NPR in Washington. And she just gave a lot of background on the kind of atmosphere there was at that time that would really make you ask yourself, what were people supposed to do? I mean, when they got this order from the Western Defense Command and Fourth Army, it read, "Instructions to all persons of Japanese ancestry. All Japanese persons, both alien and non-alien, will be evacuated from this designated area by 12 noon, Tuesday, April 7th. That's what one of the notices read. And in Hawaii, well, a third of the population was Japanese, so mass incarceration would not have worked too well. Like 90% of the carpenters at that time were Japanese. They couldn't build a barracks for them. So they were really selective about who they took in here in Hawaii, and that made it really scary, and it really kind of changed the social dynamic. You know, I mean, Catherine, what if, here I am sitting next to you, what if one day I'm just gone? Would you kind of wonder what happened and what I had done?
Yes, I just was at a screening. Bar Association did a screening of the film, and then they came for us, and one of the ladies mentioned that she had an aunt that was on her way from Maui, I think, to go to college in St. Louis, and on her way over, she was taken then to an internment camp. So instead of college, she went to a camp.
People were honestly grabbed off the street, and it's really something that comes alive when you hear what they wrote about it, which is what the docents from the Japanese Cultural Center are so good at. We went out there with a couple of their champion docents. Let me tell you, Honouliuli, when you go there, the valley, the sides seem really steep, and it's just covered with haulikoa and stuff all over, and there's a rutted road that you can go in on. You can stand on these concrete slabs there that are the former barracks, the former mess hall, and it's all above Honouliuli Stream. I wanted to let you hear Jane Kurahara, one of the docents, sharing from Jack Yoshikami's memoir. He was picked up, just pulled out of his house after a day at work, and this is what he said about the hearing he faced after his arrest.
Interrogation by the authorities started with various questions about my personal background, eventually ending with a question, "Do you think it is better for Japan to win this war?" If I answered it was better for Japan to win, I would be sent to the detention center as an enemy alien. If I answered I like America to win, they would insistently say, "Don't lie. I know you're really praying for Japan to win."
Uh-huh. I mean, you forget that those kinds of interrogations happen. We have to ask ourselves what we would do at every turn. I mean, volunteer Betsy Fujii Young led us down to the stream over there and painted the scene of how the camp would have looked all around us. And she shared some inspiring words from former U.S. Secretary of Transportation Norman Mineta.
Norman Mineta says, "This is not about the past. This is about the future. Because history has already had the ability to repeat itself. What you are doing here is drawing that line in the sand to say that never again will these things happen to anyone."
Yellow peril, yes.
Yeah. I mean, really, it makes you think out there. They share poems and even a song that was written after somebody had visited out there at Honoliuli. They take people out once a month. You can sign up for this tour, and it really is the only way to visit Honoliuli right now. It's a National Historic Site, which is super cool because the National Park Service, we met a representative this time out there, and they're so behind the sharing of this story and are working right now on the groundwork to make it more available for people. Right now, you can go there through tours with the Japanese Cultural Center. They've also made a curriculum for high school students on this, and they've got a really good education sort of section of their website, as well as a permanent exhibit that's at the Cultural Center on Beretania Street. Oh, and one last thing. You know, it's such a great moment at the end of the visit to be able to walk down to the stream. And in this case, Betsy helped us just place ourselves with the mess hall there and various people's memories. And even a poem was read down there at the stream. And she played a song that someone had written after visiting Honoliuli. We gathered and they passed out rose petals and we tossed them into Honoliuli stream, thinking about the words of Norman Mineta.
I don't understand. Are we restrained when we love this land?
That was HPR's former arts and culture reporter Noe Tanigawa, who joined the conversation to talk about the Yellow Bowl Project, which traveled to Oahu's Honoliuli National Historic Site back in 2019. You can see Setsuko Sato Winchester's art installations online at yellowbowlproject.com. That does it for today's show, reflecting on a half a century since the repeal of an executive order that sent thousands of Japanese Americans to internment camps during World War II. Up tomorrow, we plan to hear from Governor Josh Green, who recently canceled a trip to Washington, D.C. We would like to hear from you. Call our talkback line and leave us your feedback. Here's that number, 808-792-8217. You can listen back to our shows on our website, or you can find the Conversation podcast on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. Join us tomorrow. Pick up the conversation.